Hello, Grave Talks family. It's Tony Bruschi. If you love the Grave Talks, you'll probably love our other podcast if you're already not a subscriber of it, Real Ghost Stories Online. The following is a 15-minute preview of this week's Extra Podcast Person, or EPP, bonus episode of Real Ghost Stories Online. I hope you enjoy. Warnings. They come in all shapes and sizes. Sometimes it's just something in your gut that tells you, you know, this isn't right. I got to do something about this. Something is not going to work out here. I'm in danger. There's no visible sign. There's no audible sign, but I am just feeling something and I don't know what it is. Sometimes you have those audible, visible signs or just something very clear come to you. Sometimes you have signs that are more than just your gut, more than just your intuition. And it's more than just something physical in the environment that's warning you. It's something supernatural, something paranormal, something from the other side that too has your best interest in mind. We don't always think about that, but I think in many cases, things on the other side are there to help us just as we would be there to help another human being. In today's episode of Real Ghost Stories Online, we hear about some situations where some folks are in danger. They're in not good places, not good situations. And it seems the supernatural intervene to try and make things better. In one case, did a fatherly spirit return to warn his daughter-in-law of the dangers she was in by being with his son? Also, a small town is ripped apart as their beloved general store owner is murdered in cold blood. Does the spirit of this man return to protect the place that he loves? We'll hear those two stories in this week's EPP bonus episode of Real Ghost Stories Online. EPP bonus episode number 303. My name is Tony Bruschi. Stay with us. Can the dead warn us of our current situations in the living realm? Give us hints, give us advice, give us warnings, or just push us in the general direction that a friend or a loved one would when maybe we cannot see or fail to heed the warnings that we are dealing with? In our next story, we hear about a family man. A family man who very much did love his family, but was abused by it. Eventually, he passed away under questionable circumstances. But his spirit seemed to live on to warn what would have been an in-law family member of the dangers of his own son. Take a listen. I've been listening to your podcast for over a year. I wanted so badly to give my submission earlier, but it's only now that I can sit and write this with clarity, as the paranormal activity I'm about to describe occurred during a very difficult time in my life. Thinking back on it is somewhat painful for me and can be a bit of a trigger. I'm from Arizona, born and raised. Around 2002, I was in my mid-20s at the time. I met a man there named Curtis. We became engaged, and shortly thereafter, he wanted to return to his family in the native state of Ohio. Thus, before marrying Curtis, I packed up and moved from Arizona to Ohio to be with him. Shortly after my arrival, Curtis and I were married in Ohio and set up a homestead there together. My new husband was an executive and often traveled for business. Time was of the essence to get things in order, and I had worked as a legal secretary and had planned to begin applying at law firms in the area. We purchased a home right away in a beautiful Ohio neighborhood with large forested lots adjacent to woods, a lake, hiking, running trail.
Choosing the house was easy. It belonged to my husband's mother, Gwen. It was not an old home. In fact, it was built in the early 90s by Gwen's second husband, an architect and builder who suddenly passed away after a tragic but fluke bicycling accident. Gwen had been living in the house, albeit largely unfinished in certain parts. See, Jeff was killed during building of the house, so there were parts that were unfinished. The house was extremely modernistic. Not particularly my style, but I realized it was a family affair to have it sold so that Gwen, who had never remarried, could downsize to a new condo she had been eyeing. I sacrificed my desires for a traditional or historic home and settled into the new modern home with Curtis. We intended to finish it, and I added some color to warm up the otherwise cold house, wherein all fixtures and walls were either black or white. Upon settling in the home, things began to change with Curtis's behavior towards me. I don't think this had anything to do with the home. I came to realize later that I just had married an extremely abusive man who had some very apparent personality disorders. Nonetheless, it had not even been a year into our marriage, and Curtis was becoming increasingly abusive towards me. He was cruel in his words, controlling, evasive, neglectful, disrespectful, and at times deliberately hurtful out of the blue. He'd often kick me in the back or elbow me in my kidneys as I slept. He'd spit at me, throw tantrums, pour liquids or cleansers on me in a fit of rage or disrespect, kick my cats and berate me. He despised my having friends and criticized me for speaking to my family back in Arizona. I recognize now this was because he did not want his good boy image tarnished to others. Conversely, the outer appearance of our marriage could be considered envious. Beautiful home, involved couple, vacations, attractive social activities. It was all a facade. My marriage was new, and it felt like I had lived a lifetime in hell. The more isolated and distressed I'd become, the worse Curtis would act towards me. It was then I started to notice a change in our house. At this point, I had been in the marriage for nearly 3 years. I was isolated and spent my days concentrating on work or law school studies or domestic duties. The psychological head games from Curtis had not ceased, despite his promises to be better. Things would be okay for a month or two, and then the pattern of abuse always presented itself again. I'd begun to suffer from anxiety as a result of this and had severe stomach issues that would not quit. I often felt ill and was home alone frequently. As Curtis traveled, I had few visitors, or I just did not feel well enough to go out with him to social functions. It was in this loneliness that I began feeling as though the house was either responding to my energy or providing me with subtle hints to get out. There were happenings I could not explain. Doors would often open for no apparent reason. As I tried to sleep at night, I could hear pounding or hammering in the attic directly above my bed. I'd hear footsteps pace the floor above me. The electric in the house seemed to have a mind of its own. I would often be woken from a sleep to hear people conversating on the television in the living room, even though I had turned the television off before going to bed. Televisions would come on and go off, lights would come on and go off, doors continued to open, even locked doors. One day my gas stove was lit suddenly. On another day, multiple birds would fly to their death directly into our 22-foot floor-ceiling windows. Some days, my car and house keys, which would customarily hang neatly on the key rack in the kitchen cupboard, could be found lying neatly on the rug center in front of our front door entrance, as if to say, "Here, now leave." Things would happen that I could not explain. The energy grew darker. I grew more isolated. Attempts to pack up and leave were thwarted by Curtis either hiding my car keys, ridding me of my wallet, cutting off or taking any of my financial resources, or on one occasion sticking the water hose in my luggage, saturating any clothes I had packed in the trunk of my car. I felt there was no one to talk to. If so, no one would believe me. Sadly, I did not care if I was not believed about the strange happenings in the house. I was more concerned at the fact that I knew no one would believe that Curtis was abusing me. Star athlete, Hall of Famer, family man, go-getter Curtis. He was too perfect to be abusive. It was around my 5th or 6th year of marriage that I had become desperate to leave and had started saving money unbeknownst to Curtis. I knew it would take years before I could take the leap to leave with any sort of financial security. I was now pregnant and could not imagine raising a child around the Jekyll and Hyde personality. My pregnancy was uneventful. I gained little weight because I was often sick. I, too, was often alone. On one occasion, while I was alone and stood on the first floor of my home, something on the second floor loft caught my eye. It had quickly moved. It appeared to be the face and head of a small child peeking around the corner of a room on the second floor that I'd been decorating to become the nursery. The head appeared to be low towards the floor as if a child had crawled to peek around the corner at me. As quickly as I saw it, it was gone. I froze in fear. I knew what I had seen. I spent nights sleeping with my door closed, the lights on, and the television going just to block out the noise of any footsteps, hammering, and the odd things that had been happening. I tried to explain these things to Curtis when he returned home from business. He laughed, stating it was probably the cats or an animal. Maybe he was right. He had heard similar noises when he was home, and it did not seem to bother him. The nursery was coming in order. My mother-in-law, Gwen, still had several things to come and collect from the attic from when she lived at the house. One day, Gwen came over and asked to work in the attic to retrieve some of her things. She'd spent the day taking down boxes. At the end of the day, when she left, I noticed a large box at the bottom of the driveway where the trash can is left for pickup. Curious, I went to see what the large box contained and if there was anything in it I might be interested in keeping. Gwen tended to throw out nice things. I, having grown up at the poverty level, making it a habit to upcycling anything I possibly could. As I skimmed through the box, I realized most of the contents were paper. Mostly drawings made by a small child of elementary age. A kindergarten graduation certificate and graduation cap. Elementary school class photos from the 60s. Report cards. A Catholic confirmation certificate. And other keepsakes that a mother would typically keep from events or art generated by a small child. I looked at the contents for a name. I recognized Jeffrey, the report cards, the school photos, everything. It all belonged to Gwen's late second husband, Jeffrey. I was appalled at discovering this and to learn that someone she claimed to have adored so much, she could have so easily discarded such precious memories of his past. I knew that Jeffrey still had living brothers and sisters, and I knew some of their names discovered through stories or run-ins, so perhaps against my better judgment, I began searching for them on social media sites and local records. I was able to discern that Jeffrey had a sister named Marie that lived nearby. I was able to locate her on social media and from there wrote a Facebook message explaining who I was and that I had some items of her brother's. She may be interested in having as I pressed send. I questioned whether I was doing the right thing. Then I waited for a response. I waited for a day. Days turned into weeks, then months. I had a small infant now. She was perfect. Her name is Sophie, the sweetest baby. And swiftly, she became my world and my one and only truest love. I cannot say that at this time, things with Curtis were better, simply different. The abuse shifted from the cursing at me, kicking me, or spitting on me to more subtle and psychological jabs. Like on one occasion, he claimed we were in financial trouble and that we were needing to file bankruptcy or we were losing the house. After I became sad over learning this, he just chuckled and said, "Take a joke. I'm only kidding." This kind of bizarre behavior escalated over the years with Curtis. On a Monday, he might claim we were losing our house, or he had cancer, or he heard I had an affair. He would escalate the drama of these misfortunes all week. Then right by Friday, he was laughing and saying it was all a joke and continued to berate me for becoming so upset. I had married a psychopath or a sociopath. And that's where we're going to pause the preview portion of this week's EPP bonus episode of Real Ghost Stories Online. Find out what happens with the spirits and the relationship, the living and the dead intersecting. We'll have it all for you. You can hear it when you become an EPP, an extra podcast person. Sign up at ghostpodcast.com or patreon.com/realghoststories. $5 a month gets you access to all of our bonus episodes, all 303 of them in their entirety. You get advanced episodes of our program released to you before they go to the general public, all commercial free. You also get our ebook and our audiobook, that right there in itself, a $30 value. They're $15 a piece if you buy them through Audible or Amazon. But you get them right there as a supporter of our program, an extra podcast person. Again, sign up at ghostpodcast.com or patreon.com/realghoststories. We'll also hear the story of a small town that's ripped apart as their beloved general store owner is murdered in cold blood. All of that and more in the rest of this week's EPP bonus episode. Ghostpodcast.com or patreon.com/realghoststories to hear it all. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.